Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:47 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday, March 24th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And this week, two reports crossed my desk that I thought were particularly interesting. And what I'd like to do is to take you through them today. One was one I posted in Comment of the Day yesterday, and it was with regard to energy. There was one chart in it that particularly caught my attention, and it is the cross section between absolute demand and energy intensity, because what we can see very clearly is that the chart of energy intensity, that our intensity of energy use, has been trending lower. So we've been making more, doing more with the energy that we use since the early 1970s. And yet absolute demand has been trending higher. Absolute demand trends higher, not least because we have had a massive expansion in the global economy, and it is contributing to not only that that everybody is using more energy, but that the number of people has increased substantially. So then demand per capita may be trending lower, but the capita part is increasing, and that's contributing to absolute demand. But then that is a factor of demographics. There is doesn't appear to be anything that could change the intensity trend, but demographics will change the demand trend. Then there have been arguments about just what it is that is going to contribute to that. When is it going to happen? When are we going to have a peak in energy demand? And of course, when we talk about energy demand, we're really talking about oil. It's oil intensity, oil, an absolute demand for oil. So when will the absolute peak for demand for oil occur? We could say that the less risky bet would be to say it's going to be when we have a peak in the global population. Then the capita part of the per capita usage will start to decline, and then that will very quickly start to be affected by that stage. Our energy intensity will have improved even better, so we'll be making even more with less energy, and as a result that would have a knock-on effect very quickly. We already know that the global birth rate has peaked. It peaked about 5 years ago. And yet the global population is projected to expand by an additional 2 billion people within the next 20 years. And part of the reason for that is because more children are surviving. So we might have a peak in the birth rate, but childhood mortality has been addressed very successfully and continues to be addressed successfully, and not least due to efforts by the Gates Foundation. So that is certainly one trend. It is a step trend. It isn't something that is going to persist. It is something that we are going to get to an acceptable level, there is no such thing as an acceptable level of infant mortality, but there is obviously going to be a point where there are a certain number are unavoidable, and we will get to that trend and then that point, and then there will be very little improvement from there. Then there is, of course, the other side of the equation, which is that people are living longer. So the people are not just they're not just surviving for longer, but that many people are surviving into their old age in better condition, which means then that their energy use continues. And again, that is also a trend that has a finite existence, because eventually we will get to a point where these two trends cease to contribute to a higher population. And at that point, then we could very easily predict that absolute demand for oil would trend lower. That is before we even begin to talk about some of the other issues that are facing the energy markets at present. And oil prices have been through major bull and bear markets over many, many decades. And when we look at the very long historical trend of oil, and we can take it all the way back to the 1890s, then we're presented with range and trend, range and trend. And we've been through a massive bull market, and now we're into a range, and these ranges have tended to last decades. And we are towards the lower side of the range, I suspect, right now. But even after the big pullback that we had in the 1970s, it was a considerable period of time before prices were successfully able to push back up into the range that was just below $40. We could be in a very similar situation on this occasion. And that represents a very important characteristic, because when commodity prices are very high, it acts as a headwind to growth. And then that has contributed, there's been one of the leading contributors to the malaise that we've had in economic growth, and to also to the ranging environment that we had on stock markets until really just the last few years. If we are now in a period of time where commodity prices are more likely to range in a secular fashion than trend in a secular fashion, then that removes the headwind from stock markets, and then we have the potential for secular bull markets in stock markets. And we have reasonably good evidence that that is what we are in now. We're in a secular bull market for equities generally, and it's being led by the outperformance of Wall Street, despite the fact that in the very short term there is the potential for some consolidation, because we've had a wonderful rally over the last 12 weeks and we are due a pullback in consolidation, and it certainly looks like we are going to get that. And because this is, generally speaking, a secular bull market environment, a significant pullback could be regarded as a buying opportunity. There was another report that crossed my desk, and it was from Merrill Lynch. And I'm not allowed to post reports from Merrill. They tend not to like that. But I thought I could take you through what I see in some of these maps. When we look at that aging profile in terms of demographics, there are a number of countries there are pink, and that would suggest that 20 to 25% of their populations are over 65. But the really big problems are in the Eurozone. That's where you have a significant number of people that are in their old age, and that is also the case for Japan, and it's also the case in I believe that's Thailand, that is in Southeast Asia. So when we look at those, we can see that when we think about the aging question, there is no prospect of an aging question in Africa. That is where the real demographic dividend is going to be in the next 20 years. They have masses of young people. India has got masses of young people and an enormous population to boot. And that is also going to represent a demographic dividend that, if they can capture it successfully, will contribute to outsized economic growth. This is an additional map that gives us at least another way of looking at this market, that it shows us how much the aged population is going to increase over the next decades. And it's going to be more of a problem in China than anywhere else, because they've got such a large population. At the same time, they are now beginning to relax their one-child policy, and I've already seen evidence that China is importing workers from other parts of Southeast Asia, and there is nothing to say that they couldn't continue to do that. And of course, the additional solution would be automation. The main solution that people have had to lower labor has been to bring women into the workforce. I think that there is a clear argument that economic growth and development is sustained when women have an equal right to everything in society. We can see very clearly that that North America, Brazil, Australia, and China have been among the leaders in equal opportunities. The Middle East is miles behind. So is India. India has a massive population, but India has done woefully badly. It must be one of the only countries in the world where textile workers are men, and that is really quite a unique phenomenon. What perhaps is most surprising about this is that there are a number of countries in Southeast Asia and in East Africa that have got very high participation rates for women in the workforce, and if one needed to make a bet, then we could perhaps say that countries like Ethiopia are going to be among the leaders in the next couple of decades, not only because they have the demographic dividend, but because they are enfranchising their female populations. And any country that gives equal opportunity to women has tended to do better in terms of its economic growth, but most particularly in the sustainability of that growth. And I did mention robots. And the US is not the leader in terms of the number of robots. Japan is. It's got 310,000 of them. China is coming up quick. They're building their own, and they've got 96,000. South Korea has got more than China, though. China has got to tackle the issue that it has with rising labor costs. And the way that it is doing that is that it, and we have clear evidence of it from Hanhai Precision or Foxconn, that they're building their own robots, and they are anticipating removing substantial numbers of workers. That will further enhance the technological innovation that you have in China. It will make the economy more productive, but of course they will then have the problem of what to do with all the workers. So there is going to have to be a considerable upskilling initiative, and not many countries have succeeded in doing that. The march of the robots would appear to be undeniable. And of course, when we think about innovation, it is perhaps also worth considering how much our country is actually spending in terms of their budgets. The US is the clear leader in terms of the absolute spend, but China is coming up very fast. What you see on, obviously, that China is lower down than the US in terms of per capita spending, but in absolute dollar terms, it is a juggernaut, and they are investing heavily, and that is unlikely to change, and that it will deliver results eventually. Let me see what else is next. Oh yes, and I think this week is particularly poignant to talk about terrorism following the events that we've had in London. But I thought this was a particularly interesting map, that terrorism is on the rise, and terrorism is global, and it is considerably more prolific than I think many people have really any understanding of. What we can also perhaps consider is that terrorism is a function of disenfranchisement. And that is despite the fact that central banks have been pumping money into the system. It is perhaps another symptom that in some countries we get a rise of populism, and generally it is in democratic countries where we get a rise in populism. But if people do not have the outlet of the ballot box, then they express their opinions in different ways, and unfortunately, that is uncontrollable, and it is something that is a considerable problem, because it is not only is it largely unpredictable, but people tend to get radicalized, and then what happens is you get the foundations for wars starting. And this is a global phenomenon. The disenfranchisement of large proportions of not just the UK population or the US population or the European population, but people everywhere is a very real phenomenon. It isn't something that is about to go away. And what has stopped the entire process from turning into an outright conflagration is that a lot of the places where terrorist activity is occurring are not particularly well armed. And by that I mean armed with an international orientation. And so that has contained the problem. But if we look at the bigger picture, we take a big step back and we look at the rise of populism and and think about terrorism not only in terms of how we are disgusted by the tactics that are employed, but rather as a symptom of a wider problem, then there is something that, if we really do want to think about what is the one big problem that could endanger the secular bull market, then it is it is war. That the rise of populism has a pretty logical conclusion. And that is why it is we have been forced, in terms of our commentary and comment of the day, to explore politics much more actively, because we have to keep an eye on what is happening, because it has a material impact on the markets. And of course, the other thing that has a material impact on the markets is debt. And this, I thought, was a really interesting graphic as well. The U.S. is And China, excuse me, the U.S. and Japan represent the kingpins of debt. The U.K. is well represented in the debt markets, but in fact, if we look at this graphic, both Germany and France have more debt than the U.K. does. And to me, at least, that was surprising. And because what we often hear about, because so much of the research that we read is written in English, is that is about the debt problems that that the UK and the USA have, and yet Germany and France have more debt than the UK, and their debt issues haven't even begun to surface because they are paying such incredibly low yields. Germany is in fact being paid to borrow money at the short end of the curve. This is not a situation that can go on indefinitely. And of course, we can see that Italy also has more debt than the UK, and that is why there are so many people who have such a focus on Italy. If you start adding together all the debt that you have in the EU, you are talking about a larger debt than Japan's. And that is something perhaps that many people don't tend to consider at all. So there are significant problems with debt in the EU, and not least because of the economic malaise that has disenfranchised so many people, and the fact that you have had austerity without the pressure release valve of a weaker, sharply weaker currency. That has represented really quite an obstacle to Europe being able to perform. And it continues to represent an issue. So when we look at, for example, European stock markets, let me just make sure everything is inside the window here. And we look at the Euro Stoxx index over the last 20 odd years. It has massively underperformed. It is perhaps moving back into a catch-up position at present, and being dragged up by its bootstraps by Wall Street, but it has underperformed, and we know why it has underperformed. And that is certainly a we cannot simply suggest that that is something that we can ignore. There is, of course, the potential that we will have a catch-up event, that the problems that the austerity regime in Europe have caused can be resolved. But the easy answer, and it is by no means the answer that the politicians might prefer, but the easy answer would be to abandon austerity and to embrace fiscal stimulus. And that would certainly help to mollify the populist trends that are currently in evidence. But whether that is possible before the German election or not is completely, I think, open to question. Everyone is now focusing on what is going to happen with the UK, what is going to happen with France, but perhaps the bigger question is whether the fact that Greece is going to run out of money in July, and that the German election is going to be in September or early October, and whether that is going to represent another problem for the German elite. There is a Europhile populist now in charge of the SPD, which is the left-wing party in Germany, and he is surging in the polls. There is the very real prospect that we will not have Angela Merkel as the Chancellor of Germany in the next parliament. And that would increase the potential that we could have a loosening of the fiscal bootstraps, and or I think perhaps better to call it the straitjacket, to let credit expand once more in the Eurozone would contribute to a catch-up potential. And of course, the other thing that a lot of people have been talking about is trade. And with populism, you generally get protectionism and a certain amount of anti-globalization fervor has taken hold. But what really stood out to me in this market, in this map, was how many countries depend on oil. And the potential that within the next 30 years we're going to hit peak oil demand, that represents an existential problem for some of these countries. And obviously the greatest challenge will be on the countries that depend most on the oil markets. Something that we have often said at the chart seminar is, when is the best time to IPO your company? It is when you can get more for it than you think it's worth. And perhaps that is now what Saudi Arabia is doing. Saudi Arabia is a country, it's not a company. They don't have quarterly results. They don't think on 12-month basis. They think in terms of decades. They think about what is the world going to look like 30 years from now. So they're IPOing their company today because they think they can get a good price for it. It is only 5% of the company at present, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to want to IPO more of it later. When we started talking about the energy markets at the beginning of this broadcast, we really only looked at the long-term trends. But technology is a massive trend, and the potential for renewables to eat into the demand for oil is a considerable potential. And I think what we can also think about is how long that's likely to take. There is something that Bill Gates has often said, and that is that we tend to overestimate what can happen in 2 years, but underestimate what can happen in 10. And the rate at which the battery density, excuse me, the energy density of batteries is improving is at about, it doubles every 5.4 years. So if a car can go 250 miles today, it will be able to go 500 miles in 5 years' time, and 1,000 miles in 10 years' time. But that's 2,000 miles in 15 years' time, and 4,000 miles in 20 years' time. if you start to think about it in terms of that exponential way of thinking about how technology tends to improve, well, then the that could have a material impact on not only our energy intensity, but also in terms of our energy demand. Because what we can see for sure is that capital is global and mobile, and that technological innovation is going global instantly. The fact that India, in just the last 4 months, has gone from 2G internet connectivity to 4G is an additional example of how quickly an emerging market can just skip entire steps in terms of its economic development. That we have really only just begun to get used to 4G in Europe, and yet in the US they are already beginning to build the infrastructure for 5G connectivity. 5G connectivity is what is going to be required to power the centralized artificial intelligence that could take control of all cars. Right now we have the Waze app, and I type into Waze, it tells me what route to take to get to where I'm going, and it is the most efficient one. And the more people around me that use it, the better the data is. It can tell me where the potholes are on the road. It'll tell me where there is a car stopped on the hard shoulder ahead, and it is very reliable. It is not such a logical leap that 20 years from now, when we have 5G connectivity or potentially even 6G connectivity, that because our cars will be loaded with sensors, that we will have radar and LiDAR and cameras, that all of that data will be being relayed in on a constant basis to a centralized intelligence, which will then take control of all cars. And then there is then that opens up the very big question about whether the people who love cars, are they going to be equated with the people who love horses? People have There are still large numbers of people who own horses, but those horses are not used for transportation. They're used for recreation, they're used for enjoyment. Is that the future of the self-driving car, of the car, excuse me, the car that we drive ourselves, where they're only driven off the main road? If it becomes less risky from an insurance perspective to hand over control to an artificial intelligence than to let a human being behind the wheel, then insurance premiums for humans would skyrocket, and then that would represent a massive shift. It could happen very quickly. So we can anticipate that something like that will happen in the next 20 years. That will revolutionize the energy sector. And by making the vehicle fleet considerably more efficient, that by cutting down on traffic, by cutting down on wait times, and then obviously by reducing the demand on oil, because batteries will be even more efficient. There is already this argument about whether a Tesla is really more efficient than a BMW 7 Series, or whether a Chevy Bolt can really fulfill one's ambitions of having a 1,000-mile journey. And that's only an argument that we're having today, at with today's technology. But if you simply roll the tape a little bit forward and think about how quickly technology innovates and how quickly we get these changes, then we can think about what the future is likely to be. And it is, does not look rosy for oil prices. It just does not look like we're going to have another secular bull market anytime soon. And what we will eventually have is we'll have supply destruction. That will create the conditions, perhaps 20 or 30 years away, for the next big bull market in oil, because it will require a massive infrastructure investment to increase the supply, just like we've had at the beginning of the 2000s. But that could be 30 years from now. And in the meantime, we could be in for a massive secular bull market in equities. We could be in for, and one of the ways to think about that, and I thought this was another really interesting map, was that just how large some companies are, just how large the US stock market is relative to the rest of the world, and the fact that Intel's free float is greater than the entire free float of Mexico is just one example. That Motorola's free float, and obviously everyone knows Motorola, that it was a big company that turned into a small company. It has a greater free float than the entire market of Greece. That McDonald's is larger than Russia. That Google and Amazon together have a larger free float than the entire Chinese market. So these are massive companies. It gives us a clear example that capitalism trends towards concentration, that the large companies eat the smaller companies and become larger, increase their dominant position. If we're thinking about which are the companies that are going to benefit, it will be the larger companies that have a history of innovation, that not only do they innovate in their own right, but that they are some of the greatest beneficiaries of the innovation that other companies produce. And that was the primary reason that we came up with the autonomies theme over 7 years ago, that it was a clear indication that these were the kinds of companies that would do well in a secular bull market. And the other, and this is, I think, a rather difficult one to invest in. I'm just going to scroll forward to the water. And let me see what number is this on 67. Sorry. That's not right. Water. If cities are going to improve, increase, and we're going to have urbanization, and that is looking increasingly likely, that the growth is going to be from cities, and that cities are going to be larger, then a lot of those cities are going to require a lot more water, and that is going to require massive infrastructure development. If it's not going to be desalination, it's going to have to be in terms of either hydro or damming or canals, and certainly in dry areas, there's going to be a large amount of desalination. It's going to represent a massive infrastructure build over the coming decades because there is a clear trend towards urbanization and greater concentrations of people in increasingly small places. So that is a major theme to think about for the long term. And if we really start to wrap it all together, we have massive technological innovation. We have a commodity market that is likely to range for a significant period of time. And when we think about what the long-term potential is, that this technological innovation is going to represent a massive bullish story, and we are only beginning to scratch the surface of what can be done in terms of biology. That the era of personalized medicine, which has been touted for decades, is very close to realization, and not least because of the revolution that has been created in terms of CRISPR-Cas9, gene editing technology. It both reduces the cost and increases the speed of experimentation and discovery in biotechnology. And that isn't just in terms of humanity, but it's in terms of the food supply as well. So these are incredibly optimistic themes. What we need is economic growth. We need the kinds of policies that will unshackle human potential, and then a lot of the problems that are being really voiced by the rise in populism will dissipate. But that is on the assumption that those kinds of policies to unshackle growth are really put in place. We cannot simply ignore the potential that populism does increase even further, and that we get more protectionism, and then we get greater. Obviously, populism has got a history of investing in infrastructure that can contribute to economic growth, but it is a different kind of economic growth than we have had in the last few decades. And it would also or pose a threat, at least, to the availability of technology and to in the emerging markets. So the rise of populism and the many ways that that can be interpreted, not least terrorism, do represent perhaps the greatest threat to the rhythmic evolution of a secular bull market. Doesn't mean that we're not going to have a secular bull market, but it will be different than what we've had in the past. And just what happens in terms of the debt markets, that we've been through a generational-long period where we've had disinflation. And if we are now approaching the end of that, and I suspect that we are approaching a turning point, well, then we could have bond yields that are higher than they are today. And whether we're going to move into another big inflationary cycle immediately is not yet proven. But there is a very strong likelihood that the lows are in, and that in terms of where the risk is in bonds because they've been going up for so long already. There is less risk in equities because they've really only just started going up. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.